I'm Dan Polsby of the Northwestern Law School, not Don Devine, as it says on your program. Mr. Devine had the choice of being here or in Florida today, and he chose Florida instead. Today's panel four is on the role of the legislative and executive branches in interpreting the Constitution. We are fortunate enough to have with us today Mr. John Harrison, the Associate Deputy Attorney General, Professor Bert Newborn of the New York University Law School and the ACLU, Professor Robert Nagel of the University of Colorado School of Law, and Mr. Stephen Ross, the Chief Counsel of the United States House of Representatives. Thanks to the extraordinarily minatory and sanguinary representations of Jan Calabresi, we really will stick to the 10-minute rule this time in order to preserve opportunities for those in the audience to ask questions subsequent to the presentation. And I understand from the panelists today that no reference will be made in their presentation to any European philosophers and literary critics. So, hereby solemnly invoke the names of Foucault and Habermas, because you won't hear them again for the next couple of hours. Our first speaker will be Mr. Harrison. John?
Thank you. I had never been to the University of Chicago Law School before yesterday, and I think this is a really great place. And I particularly like the fact that everything has a name, and everything's got a sponsor. It's kind of like being at the Olympics. I was wondering which of those people were janitors, but I guess we know the answer to that. Back where I went to law school in New Haven, we didn't think of ourselves as janitors. We thought of ourselves as sanitation policy engineers. The specific form of the question that we're talking about that I want to address is this. Are the President and Congress, in the exercise of their constitutional duties and powers, legally obliged to follow the court's interpretations of the laws of the United States, where those interpretations exist as precedents rather than as judgments in specific cases? My answer is that in the strict legal sense, they are not obliged to follow precedent as opposed to judgments, but that as a general rule, they will be very well advised to do so in order to keep the government functioning smoothly. The entire argument that I'm going to make depends on the distinction between legal rules and sound conduct, which takes into account legal rules. I want to start the analysis with a discussion of the ordinary citizen under the U.S. Constitution. He has a legal obligation to obey the law. That's an analytic truth. The law of the United States consists of the Constitution, which is paramount, statutes of Congress, and treaties. Fortunately, since Professor Krosky no longer teaches at this law school, I don't have to include the common law as a law of the United States, and I can avoid considerable complications by leaving it out. Now, the courts interpret these paramount sources of law. What they say about the Constitution or a treaty or a statute. And what they say is right or wrong, depending on what the Constitution, treaty, or statute really means. If you are a litigant and you have the law on your side in your case and you lose and you should have won, the fact that you were right doesn't necessarily do you any good, but it is still meaningful to say that you are right and to say that the court was wrong, that what the court said is something other than what the law really is. To emphasize the primacy of legal obligation, as opposed to what the court tells you your legal obligation is, I want to take two cases. In the first, you take a position that, on a question of law, plan interpretation of a statute that has never come up before, the judge decides that you're wrong. What happens? You lose. In the second case, it's exactly the same, except that there was controlling precedential authority from a higher court on the point, authority that went against you, authority that you didn't know about. What happens there? You lose. Then you fire your lawyer. Legal realism is an accurate description of the market for legal services. But are the cases otherwise any different, except that your lawyer is now out of work? In particular, are there any additional consequences from defying precedential authority? Well, if the point is well enough known, you may have to pay the other side's attorney's fees because you wasted everybody's valuable time. But if, for example, the law you misinterpreted was a criminal statute, have you committed two felonies? One of violating the law and one of misreading the precedents? Of course you haven't. In the standard case, the sanction for defying the court's interpretation of the law is coextensive with the sanction for defying the law. You lose. Any incidental trouble you get into for wasting other people's time doesn't change the basic point. The law is the law, and that, primarily, is what you're obliged to obey. That's the case of the ordinary citizen. Does anything change when we move to the case of the non-judicial branches? Now, I'm going to be talking about the president because it's easier to talk about the president because he does most of these things and because Mr. Ross is available to speak for the first branch, but it could be either of the two political branches that I'll be talking about. Is the obligation of the president any different from the obligation of an ordinary citizen under the law? Well, the president takes an oath to the Constitution, and the Constitution says that he shall faithfully execute the laws. Now, I agree that he has an obligation to obey judgments and, where necessary, to execute judgments against other peoples. People. Other peoples would get us into international law, and we can leave that out. But does he have any obligation of that sort to follow precedent where there is no binding judgment in the situation? I don't know of one. His obligation, like that of any citizen, is to the law, and primarily to the supreme law. Some people, however, think that the president is obliged to follow precedent in exactly, and that gets confusing, president and precedent, right? Follow precedent in exactly the sense he is obliged to obey the law. Now, where might such an obligation come from? I want to talk about two possible sources, which I think are the ones we encounter most often. The first is the argument that the Constitution gives the job of interpreting the law primarily to the courts, perhaps exclusively to the courts, and specifically to the nation's juridical head, the Supreme Court of the United States. Well, now, how do we know this? I suppose we know it because Marbury against Madison says so. It is the power and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. Well, the answer to the claim that the Constitution allocates the interpretive power to the courts is, no, it doesn't. Show me where it does. It allocates the case-deciding power to the courts, and that's where the requirement to follow judgments comes from. But the power to interpret the Constitution comes from the case-deciding power. To suggest that the power to interpret is primary and the case-deciding power is secondary is to get the Constitution wrong and indeed to confuse cause and effect. The second argument, which is a little fuzzier and a little more subtle. As we all know, the president and the entire executive branch have to make all sorts of decisions in applying the law. They have a huge government to run, and they have to look at the law a lot. The argument that they have to follow precedent when they do that is that if they didn't, there would be a mess, and there would be constant litigation where people were trying to force them to follow precedent, and they'd constantly lose. Well, that argument has something to it, but it's not an argument about legal obligation. It is an argument about what is a sane way to run a government, what is an intelligent thing for the president to do. Yes, there'd be a mess if he always defied the precedents, and that's why he doesn't do it. Now, what I want to point out here is that there is a fundamental error in proceeding from arguments about good ways to run the government to arguments about legal obligation. And let me phrase the question this way. Does the president have an obligation to make the government run smoothly? In a sense, he does. But it's his obligation to be a good president. It's not his obligation to follow the law. Now, underlying what I've just said is a distinction between the things the president is legally obliged to do and the things he ought to do in order to get his job done right. Now, the Constitution has in it all sorts of incentives to do his job well, incentives that appeal to his patriotism, to his love of honor, and to his love of power. But those incentives aren't legal obligations. Even more fundamentally, The commands of the Constitution are to be distinguished sharply from what we might call its expectations. Those are the results that the Constitution will produce if those who made it were correct in their predictions of political science about how people will respond to their incentives and what they will do. What I'm saying, then, is that you can abide by the Constitution, follow your legal obligation, and still cause the Constitution to defeat the motivations that underlie it. Let me give a silly illustration. Suppose the Senate stops confirming judges. They just don't want to confirm any more judges. Pretty soon, we start running out of judges. Is the Senate behaving irresponsibly? Yes. Is the Senate behaving unconstitutionally? No. I can't stress too much the distinction between expectations and legal obligations. The Constitution is set up so that, as far as possible, it makes legal obligations fairly clear, especially on structural questions like who decides what, how many senators from every state, the really important things. The clearer, the better. It is designed so that those obligations will have certain consequences. They create incentives, people do certain things, the whole system runs some way. But to look behind the obligations to the design is to misunderstand how the Constitution operates. The design, the purpose in the broader sense, isn't the same thing as the content of the constitutional rules. If in order to understand the two senators' provision, we had to debate whether the interests of the small states were being consulted enough in legislation, we'd never figure it out. But two senators from every state, we can figure out. That's how the Constitution works. That's how the really important parts of the Constitution work. And they work by cutting off the larger purposes, the predictions of political science, from the simple content of the rules. That arrangement, that way the Constitution works, and this is my final point, is an instance of an even more fundamental concept that is basic not just to the Constitution, but to the entire rule of law, and it is one form of the concept of legal formality, the form that distinguishes between the purpose of the lawmaker and the content of the law, and that says that the judge's job, or the interpreter's job generally, is to understand the rule, and that, at least as to certain rules, he need not consult the purpose. He need not consult the expected outcome state. He need only know what the rule is. The fundamental character of formalism is something I could go on about, but instead, since I'm running out of my 10 minutes, I will suggest that we just think about it some more. Thank you. If there is some time left at the end, I'm going to volunteer to tell the story from the 39th Congress about the gypsies.
Professor Bert Newborn.
Thank you. I am delighted to be here and delighted to be invited. As many of you know, I've spent a good part of the last 20 years as both a law professor and as a litigator for the American Civil Liberties Union. And over those years, have harbored a heretical belief, perhaps, but one that I confess to you today, and that is and of course it's not a particularly novel belief, that the political spectrum is much better represented as a circle than a line, and that libertarians at both ends of the spectrum sometime are much closer together than the people in the middle. And I do suspect that there is a great unity of interest between many of us who labor in the libertarian groves, even though we may differ very dramatically on particular positions and way one gets the ways one gets there. Let me raise with you this afternoon the problem of precedent, really, because the question of how one construes the Constitution as an executive branch or the legislative branch, until the courts act, of course, there's no problem. Each branch does the best it can. But assume with me, if you will, that the Supreme Court has acted and has acted in a way that is indisputably formally complete. People will disagree or agree with the correctness or incorrectness of the court's decision, but either in construing a statute or construing the Constitution, assume with me that the court has laid down an intelligible and finite rule. And the question now is, what is the duty or obligation of the other two branches of government with respect to the precise rule, the precise holding of the case that the Supreme Court decides? Now, there are two polar positions that have been set out. The first polar position we heard beautifully expounded a moment ago, and that's the position that precedent, even Supreme Court precedent, is essentially a prediction. It is essentially a predictive notion of future consequences, and that the government, as any other actor in a system, will take into account the potentiality of future consequences in its behavior, and since it is likely to get hauled into court and shellacked if it fails to follow the precedent, it therefore, as a matter of self-interest, ought to and probably will, in the vast majority of situations, comply with the precedent. That theory, and it is a respectable theory, flows from a hard and sharp reading of Marbury, which says that after all, the court's power to expound the law in the first place comes from the power to decide a case, and that is essentially an in-house judicial function, and of course the courts will continue in-house to do what they think they should, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the other two houses of the government, the executive and the legislature, when they are performing their in-house duties, are obliged to defer to the judgments of the courts. That leaves us, if that is in fact a correct interpretation of what the Constitution permits or even requires, it leaves us with the notion of a cacophonous Constitution, a Constitution that speaks with many mouths simultaneously to the populace, with the judicial construction simply being correct because it's going to be the last one, not because it is the one that one ought to follow. That's the consequences of one side. The polar position, the position on the other side, is that as long as the decision complied with the formal constraints of Marbury, as long as we satisfy the Article III case and controversy requirements, that the decision of a Supreme Court ought to be treated, that precedent ought to be treated as creating a positive duty to comply. It ought to be treated as the enunciation of a positive rule of law, not simply a rule of prediction, but a rule of law that carries with it the duty to comply. Now let me make four quick distinctions before we go on to talk a little bit more about what that duty might look like. First, I want to distinguish the notion of duty from the notion of sanction. We are not talking about necessarily making every violation of a precedent a contempt of court. That, I think, would be an extraordinary enhancement of judicial power and very bad policy, and I see no reason to even argue for it. But we are simply asking about whether or not there is some formal duty, formal legally recognizable duty to comply with precedent, leaving aside now the question of sanction. Secondly, I want to distinguish the government from private persons, because we may have a very, very different theory in determining the way the government, the way a private person ought to relate to a Supreme Court precedent, and the way one of the branches of government or one of the states or local governments should relate to precedent. And I'd like to talk this afternoon only about the duty of a government official in the executive or the legislative branches and the way they would relate to precedent. Third, let me distinguish legal duty from the right to criticize and the right to try to foster change by any lawful means, either by continually relitigating the issue, by attempting to overrule it through the legislature, or by constitutional amendment. There cannot be any principled argument that says that once the Supreme Court acts, everybody has to roll over and accept what they say is correct. Of course, criticism and attempts to change and foster relitigation are part of the system and should be encouraged, and there can be no argument from judicial precedent that as a principled matter would cast any doubt on the legitimacy of that type of activity. And finally, let me reiterate the difference between holding and dictum. It seems to me that where you're dealing with dictum, there is no argument that dictum can be any more than a predictive phenomenon. Dictum cannot be read as creating a positive law because it goes beyond the Article III powers of the courts in the first place. And although it may give you a hint as to what they're going to do in the future and therefore allow you to order your conduct in an efficient way, it cannot be read and should not be read as creating a positive duty to obey. So we're talking only about holdings. We're talking only about the narrow precedential holding of the case. My thesis is that once you have a narrow precedential holding of a case that way, there is a legal duty on the part of the organs of government, the other two branches of government, to defer to the reading of the Constitution and a statute that is given by the court, and that it is a legal duty that flows not from real politic, not from the notion that they'll be overruled if they're forced into court again, but from a positive legal obligation to comply with the law as it is enunciated by a court pursuant to the mandates of Article III and Marbury versus Madison. Let me stress that there's a limited practical difference between the two positions that you that you're hearing. I would expect that whether one views it as a matter of real politic or a matter of legal obligation, in the vast bulk of situations, you're going to have compliance. Although it is an important matter of legal theory, and it can be quite important pragmatically to individuals in a number of cases, one ought not to exaggerate the practical consequences of accepting either position here. We are not talking about a breakdown of the rule of law under either theory. We are talking about, however, a very important legal theory, a dispute about what the theory should be. Let me also stress that there may be nuances as between the executive and the legislative branch. that since I believe that it is necessary and indeed helpful to foster relitigation of these issues, there can be no argument that people should be forced to refrain from activity that would permit the relitigation of important issues. And therefore, under those circumstances, you may well have a slightly different position if you're a legislator than if you're an executive branch. There may be slight nuances in the degree of compliance that's required. Now, with those qualifications, let me quickly sketch out what the consequences of you of thinking about law solely as a predictive device would be, and then ask you whether or not those consequences are required by the Constitution, and suggest that indeed they are not, they are forbidden by the Constitution. The first is the law's impact on pre-event behavior. The degree to which the Constitution and the rules of statutes are capable of exerting serious primary effect on primary behavior. I think all of us agree that law acts best when it acts without the necessity of enforcement. The moment that you abandon the notion that the law as expounded by the court creates a legal duty to obey, what you do is you create a situation where you have at least three and perhaps more equally legitimate expositors of what the law is. At that point, you have a cacophonous voice in which it is virtually impossible to expect the Constitution or a statute to affect primary behavior in a significant way, because the people who are trying to accord their behavior in accordance with what they understand the law to be are being told three different things by three different bodies, each of which has legitimate authorization. It is precisely the regime that we abandoned under Swift versus Tyson as being impossible in a jurisprudence that hopes to use law as a form of achieving primary behavior control. Secondly, and I think equally important, the other real importance of law is to ascribe consequences to behavior after the event. Think for a moment of what the consequences of a non-acquiescence position would be in the area of post-event behavior. It would mean that anybody with the resources to seek a second judicial opinion could go into court and enjoy the benefit of the rule of law as expounded by the court. But those segments of the society that lack access to the courts because they simply lack the resources to get there would be obliged to live under whatever set of rules they happen to be able to afford to get to, which means essentially what the executive says the law is. And that means that the nature of the justice that would be dispensed in the society would be a function of the resources of the individuals in the society. I suggest to you that a vision of law that says that the law depends on how much money you can afford and how far you can go, and not on some self-executing duty to comply, is one which is basically inconsistent with our values. Now, only a very naive view of law could argue for such a result. You have to think that there is an objectively correct interpretation of a statute or an objectively correct interpretation of the Constitution to which all three branches have a right to attempt to repair. I suppose one can think of the Constitution as that type of naive document, but I know of no one who thinks that there is a single right answer to a lot of these questions. These are very hard questions. Once we admit that interpretation and choice enters into the equation of statutory construction and constitutional law, it seems to me that the jurisprudential underpinnings of compelling a resort to the kind of jurisprudence that has the results I've just suggested is really impossible. The Constitution doesn't require one or the other. We have a choice. We can decide whether we want a cacophonous Constitution or one that speaks through a single judicial voice. It seems to me that based on pre-event and post-event behavior, there really is only one choice, and that is to view the law of the Supreme Court as positive law until it is changed. Thank you. I'm afraid I took one more minute.
Professor Nagel.
I want to spend my 10 minutes simply proposing a small amendment to an aspect of the argument that Attorney General Meese made in his Tulane speech. I think we might as well mention that, since it is the subject we're talking about, and he raised it first. At any rate, I think his speech is interesting because he is arguing partially as a pragmatic matter He's urging the citizenry to have a certain point of view with respect to their right to criticize, or their, even their obligation to criticize, the opinions of the Supreme Court. In other words, he's addressing the public and the public's officials, and emphasizing, I think, that they should maintain in their own minds a clear distinction between the court's interpretations of the Constitution and the document itself. That to the extent the document is merged in the public understanding with the court's interpretations of the document, to the extent that the court's opinions are the law of the land in that sense, in the sense that they're binding on everyone, I think as a matter of degree, then the Attorney General was urging that you tend to lose the possibility of criticism and therefore correction of decisions. Now, this argument, or this aspect of the argument, seems to me to be potentially important but slightly wrong. When people say that courts' judicial interpretations are the law of the land, what they mean, of course, is that there's a duty to obey. And I agree with both Professor Newborn and Mr. Harrison that the duty to obey does not necessarily entail any confusion of the court's opinions with the original document. Even direct parties to a case, it's true, can lose and still criticize the court's interpretation as being wrong vis-a-vis the ultimate legal standard. However, I think that the Attorney General's point can be shifted slightly. That is, it seems to me what is useful to do is to focus on the effects of the, so to speak, law of the land mentality, not on the public, but on the court itself. It seems to me that it is sensible to believe that the larger the court believes the public's duty to obey is, the more expressed disagreements will be perceived by the court as illicit or as evasions or as improper confrontations, rather than as points of view that are entitled to at least some attention and respect. I think that in important areas such as school desegregation, abortion, and prison litigation, we can see that the court's exalted view of its rulings as the law of the land have in fact distorted constitutional interpretation by converting the fact of expressed disagreement or resistance in the political arena into grounds for altering and enlarging constitutional principles. Under this mentality, public dissent is perceived by the court as defiance, and in response to the defiance, the court defines the meaning of the Constitution, not because of precedent or text or history or even some consideration of moral philosophy that someone might think relevant, but because of the court's effort to protect itself from what it perceives as illegitimately motivated disagreement. What I'm suggesting to you is that the disagreement itself becomes a cause of constitutional meaning. I'll give you one quick example that from a case you're probably all familiar with. In the Thornburg case, the court invalidated a series of so-called informed consent requirements for abortions. It seems to me that the opinion is more than what we've become used to. It's full of extravagant claims on the part of the court. The requirement of the state of Pennsylvania that women be informed of the detrimental physical and psychological effects of abortions, including medical risks, was said by the court to be, quote, the antithesis of informed consent, unquote. The court gave a reason for this surprising conclusion. Its reason was that the information would, quote, increase the patient's anxiety, unquote. Now, it seems to me obvious that this confuses the possible effects of receiving information with ignorance. Now, it is true that the consent provisions of the statute involved were almost certainly designed to discourage abortions. But I don't think that fact justifies the court's assertion that the scheme, quote, wholly subordinated the constitutional privacy interest. It seems to me obvious that efforts to persuade someone against using or utilizing a constitutional right are not the same as the total subordination of that constitutional interest. The extravagance of the claims made in the Thornburg decision seemed to me to suggest that the opinion was driven as much by anger at perceived defiance as by the merits of the case. It's one thing, as in Cooper against Aaron, for the court not to yield a constitutional principle because of violent opposition. It's another thing, and one that I think is becoming a part of modern constitutional culture, for the reach and the meaning of constitutional principles to grow simply because the court can't tolerate expressed official disagreement. How far this attitude has enlarged in recent years, I think, is well demonstrated by the Thornburg decision. After all, not only didn't Roe against Wade decide the consent issue raised by Thornburg, not only was it a matter of precedent, it was not a matter of precedent, but in theory, at least, the provision of information might even be consistent with the right articulated in Roe rather than inconsistent with it. So it seems to me that the shift that has taken place rather dramatically since from Cooper against Aaron up to our present modern time in cases like Thornburg is that we're becoming accustomed to the idea that the direction, the emphasis, even the mood of Supreme Court opinions is a kind of official orthodoxy binding on everyone else in the society. And when those other parts of the society don't accept the orthodoxy, the punishment is changed and expanded constitutional meaning. So in summary, what I would say, what I'm trying to suggest to you in this brief amount of time, is that to the extent the court doesn't recognize that interpretation is a shared enterprise, the meaning and limits of constitutional principles will be defined in response to wholly irrational and irrelevant considerations, namely the court's anger. It seems to me Thornburg suggests three circumstances that make officially expressed disagreement with Supreme Court opinions particularly appropriate. One is the issue wasn't clearly decided by a prior decision. Two is that the underlying constitutional issue that had been decided was exceedingly doubtful, as evidenced even by dissenting views on the Supreme Court. And three, the kinds of considerations, moral and otherwise, that went into were necessarily a part of the constitutional judgment were issues of a kind that ordinary experience and ordinary thinking of non-lawyers in the general public is at least relevant to, and that the court has no monopoly on. Thank you.
Mr. Ross.
Good afternoon. I am Steve Ross, and I have spent most of my professional life as a lawyer representing the interests of Speaker O'Neill, Speaker Wright, and the House of Representatives that they have presided over, normally in disputes with the Department of Justice. That being so, when I got an invitation to come and talk with the society about Attorney General Meese's speech at Tulane, I took it that I was not being asked to come and sing a harmonious part in the chorus praising the Attorney General's view of the world. However, when I reviewed again the Attorney General's speech, I found that in large part, the ideas that he put forward are neither remarkable nor particularly controversial. And let me go through and tick off a couple of the main parts of that speech that people have not focused on yet today that I think there is a broad consensus on. The first is that there's a difference between the Constitution itself and constitutional law, which he described as the body of decisions of the Supreme Court. That is hardly something that can be argued with. The second is that the Supreme Court decisions do not have an absolute sense of finality about them. Again, that is something that cannot be argued with. Certainly, the Supreme Court has reversed itself, has been reversed by the passage of amendments, and it is folly to suggest that the Supreme Court, once it decides something, that the issue is forever closed. Finally, the Attorney General said that he wanted to make it clear that the art of constitutional interpretation was not the sole province of the court. That, again, is an area where there can be broad agreement. The Congress, on an everyday basis, perhaps not as effectively as some might hope, but on an everyday basis does engage in constitutional interpretation. There are many bills that are proposed either from within the institution or from outside that get thrown on the in the trash bin simply because the members feel that they would be unconstitutional if they were enacted. The fourth point that the Attorney General made, and the one that I'll spend the rest of my time discussing, is the one that is controversial. And let me quote for you for a moment exactly what he said in this regard. In talking about Supreme Court decisions, he said, "But such a decision does not establish a supreme law of the land that is binding on all persons and all and parts of government henceforth and forevermore." Let me suggest that there is a difference between a Supreme Court decision binding the President of the United States and the underlying law, be it the Constitution or a statute binding the President of the United States. I think that if we look at it in terms of the either the Constitution or the statute being the device that is binding the President, then it follows that the executive branch is to that extent bound by the decision of the Supreme Court, because what the decision is doing, it is not stating a law in of itself. It is simply explaining what either the Constitution says or what the law says, and that explanation, I suggest to you, is binding on the executive branch when it attempts to execute or administer the law. Now, I've limited my focus on the binding nature of those decisions and the underlying law to the executive, because I'm here to say that it does not have the same binding effect within the legislative branch, and I'll explain why, nor does it have the same binding effect on the president in his role in the legislative process, which is a role which should not be denigrated and is a role that the president plays very well. The reason I say that is that the Congress, if faced with a decision from the Supreme Court that it doesn't agree with, has at its disposal the option of passing another law, perhaps the exact same law, and seeing whether on second consideration the Supreme Court will think differently. That has on occasion happened. And in fact, there are occasions where the Supreme Court has invited the Congress to submit the question again. When the president participates in the legislative process by suggesting the passage of laws, by vetoing a message on the grounds of constitutionality and sending it back, and the result being not an override, but the passage of a substantially different bill, which has taken into account the objections that the president has registered. He has participated in the legislative process and certainly should not be foreclosed by any prevailing decision of the Supreme Court. It is entirely permissible for the president to veto legislation on the grounds that he believes it to be unconstitutional, notwithstanding the fact that there may be in existence a ruling of the Supreme Court that holds directly to the contrary. The president is well within his constitutional prerogatives in issuing such a veto, just as the Congress would be well within their constitutional prerogatives in passing a statute notwithstanding a Supreme Court decision. I think what it comes down to is that the Attorney General use of the word final or in describing the effect of a Supreme Court decision is mistaken. The effect that the Supreme Court decision has is that it is the prevailing reading of the law. And it is the president's obligation in executing the law or administering the law to follow that law, be it constitutional or statutory. and where there is a prevailing reading of the law, he has no constitutional warrant to ignore the law of the land in implementing either enacted statutes or constitutional provisions. And so to that limited extent, I would disagree with John and say that that there are instances in which the president cannot feel free simply for his desire to raise a test case, or simply because he believes the law is so unconstitutional that he cannot see how a court might have upheld it, that those are not sufficient excuses to allow him to abrogate his responsibility to execute the law as it has been enacted.
Thank you. Well, I was afraid we wouldn't get enough disagreement out of this group. Those of you that have the idea of asking questions should be formulating them, and you'll have the opportunity to ask questions shortly. John, would you like to offer any rebuttal or further commentary or your story about the gypsies, in default of which I have a question for you, but go ahead.
The story about the gypsies, which was discussed this morning, is that in the debates over what is now the first sentence of the 14th Amendment, which makes everybody born in the United States a citizen of the United States and of the state wherein he resides, the senator from Pennsylvania was quite exercised about this and didn't want the question of citizenship taken away from the states and nationalized. And he began to complain loudly about all the gypsies in Pennsylvania and the fact that the state had been overrun with gypsies. And now, under this proposal, all of their children would become American citizens, and what a horrible idea, and how could they bear this sort of thing? And he pointed to the senator from California and said, surely you have this problem with the Chinese. And the gentleman from California said, we have no problem with the Chinese. Chinese born in the United States and brought up in the United States are Americans, and we're happy to welcome them into citizenship. And the senator from Pennsylvania went on some more about states' rights. And finally, the guy from California said, I find it interesting to see that the senator from Pennsylvania is so concerned with handling this problem all on his own. I had no idea that there was an invasion of Pennsylvania by gypsies taking place. The last invasion of Pennsylvania I remember was by rebels, and I don't recall that Pennsylvania said she wanted to take care of it all by herself. Quite the contrary, she was happy to have all the help she could get from the rest of the Union. That was the exchange on gypsies. I want to make one sort of diagnostic suggestion. Based on what Bert said, and it may show where we are in different locations are on some of these axes. The last thing he said was that you don't want to have sort of a naive version of right answerism. I subscribe to a fairly naive version of right answerism, not so naive as to think that it's easy to find the right answers, but strong enough to say that it's meaningful to say that there is a right answer, even if we don't know exactly what it is. And I think that how hard your notion of law is and how much you believe in right answerism is a barometer of where you will put considerations like the two considerations he urged, which are very real ones, about certainty and about possible unfairness of people who can't afford to go to court to get the executive overruled. And the harder your concept of law, the more likely you are to put those, as I do, on the prudent side of the law prudence line. And sort of the softer your notion of law and the more kinds of considerations you allow into what is law and what is legally correct, the more likely you are to allow considerations like that to influence your judgment of what is or is not a legal obligation.
Bert, do you want to respond?
Just to say two things. First, I think that was an exceptionally perceptive diagnosis, really, of what probably differentiates people who think that the Supreme Court or that the decisions of the circuit courts as well carry with it some positivist sanction, and people who think that that they don't. It really turns in an almost paradoxical way on how sure you are you know what the right answer is. People like me who have a good deal of skepticism about the notion that there is a single right answer to almost any difficult judicial problem. Sure, there are easy cases, but the hard cases that that confront the court, both in statutory and constitutional questions, seem to me to almost always carry with them powerful arguments on both sides that require not a kind of dogmatic assertion that there is a single objectively existing external barometer that tells you when a court is right or wrong. It seems to me that the great challenge of modern jurisprudence is to deal with error deflection in those vast body of cases where there is genuine doubt as to what the right answer is. And only a jurisprudence that, and I say this not in terms of a pejorative statement, because I think it's descriptive, only a naive jurisprudence, and by naive I mean a jurisprudence that says there really is a single right answer, there is some sort of objective, knowable fact that if only people would think hard and investigate hard enough about it, they would find the right answer to hard judicial questions. If that is in fact true, then all the branches of government should have an equal right to look for it. If what we're doing is looking for the law of gravity, everybody should be able to look for the law of gravity. But if, as I think in a much, much more sophisticated conception of law, law is an interplay between text, intent, and the institutional organ given the responsibility of making determinations and breaking ties, then we have a situation where the very indeterminacy of law cries out for some form of authoritative voice to speak it. And that authoritative voice in our system is the court.
Do you have a further remark, Bob?
I think I'll wait for questions.
Steve?
Yes, and I noticed that I ended a little bit early, and so I may reclaim some of that time now.
You have 3 minutes and 41 seconds, Steve.
If I can bring a note of practicality to our discussion, and that is these questions as to whether or not the president is bound by the law come up in the real world, and what it boils down to is whether the president, or normally someone else in the executive branch, will either follow a law as enacted by the Congress, or on the other hand, whether they will refuse to follow the dictates of the Congress. There are instances where, and one that comes to mind, which was a recent confrontation between the House and the President, was over the Competition and Contracting Act, a bill that was designed, perhaps ill-advisedly or not, but a bill that was designed to cut the cost of particularly defense contracting by bringing a greater degree of competition into the contracting process. The president thought that certain aspects of the bill were unconstitutional. Notwithstanding those constitutional concerns, he decided to sign the legislation that included the language into law. The attorney general then wrote an opinion discussing what the executive branch thought was unconstitutional about the law, and the director of OMB then instructed all departments of the executive branch to ignore the law. Now, I don't believe that that is a power or prerogative that's within the ken of the executive department. It seems to me that the president, when faced with what he believes is an encroachment by the Congress into his constitutional prerogatives, has two alternatives. The first, which he forswore in this case, would have been to veto the bill and to see whether the Congress could have mustered the supermajority necessary to pass this objectionable law into statute. The second would have been to await for an appropriate case to arise, and there were people that would have challenged the law, and to hope that the court would have agreed with his view of the law as opposed to the Congress's view of the law under our Constitution. But I think it is dangerous to any system, which is a system which is based on the rule of law, for the executive to think that he has the third option open to him, which is to simply say that those laws which he does not agree with on constitutional terms, that he will ignore, either if it is a law which is intended to have the executive do something, or whether it's a law that it's intended to have the executive stopped or stopped from doing something.
Can I?
Please.
Say something about that? That is certainly an important issue in this context, and again it points up the differences in approach, because what the president is saying when he's got an unconstitutional law, and I would suggest, to make the issue a little clearer, and I know this is sort of rhetorically helpful to me, and so you don't have to follow it if you don't want to, say that an earlier president had signed it, and a new one comes in. I mean, there's a difficulty in the same president signing it and then not applying it. What the president is saying is this, which this Congress passed, is a statute of the United States, but it's contrary to the Constitution, and I can't follow it. That is formally exactly like what John Marshall does in Marbury against Madison. And so to say that the courts can do it and the president can't do it is to appeal to the notion that the courts have the special role. And I think it's exactly that issue on which we're differing.
Suppose he said that and the case was brought and the president lost.
Which is what happened.
What does he do in the next case? Does he say in the next case, I lost the last time, but that was just the last time, and since I have a continuing right to construe the Constitution my own way, I'll just keep on refusing to enforce this law, and anybody who wants to make me do it has got to drag me into court and get a court order directly against me. Isn't that what the real practical problem is in ascribing to the president or the executive branch an autonomous power to construe the Constitution and law even after the courts have spoken?
Absolutely, it is. And I think that if the president thinks it's important enough, that the constitutional issue is important enough, or that the political issue is important enough, that he has a legal right to do that he has to be prepared to take the political heat that he will get from doing that, but that it is legally entirely permissible for him, just as it is for an individual, to say, okay, sue me.
And I would disagree with that, because under the Constitution, the individual does not have the obligation to enforce the law that the president does. And for the president to become a lawbreaker is not what is intended by our constitutional system.
Well, we have a queue developing of...
They're not going to rush the stage.
Of potential interrogators, and I want to recognize these alternatively. Sir, will each of you please state for the recorded record your identity?
Thank you, Professor. My name is Bill Wilkin. My question, I'm in Baltimore, and my question is for Mr. Ross. Steve, I work for the Secretary of Health and Human Services, enforcing statutes that have been passed by your client. Is there any, frankly, we talk about, you know, the executive branch, all, you know, most of my life is controlled, and the battles I fight, with Mr. Freed's permission, are in defense of statutes that your clients have compromised and worked out through a very elaborate and time-tested procedure with some very clear and specific language. And since you know that I do a lot of work with the Social Security Act, you know that you and your clients spend a lot of time periodically amending it and fine-tuning that very carefully. Is there any kind of outrage or even sophisticated notice being made that, you know, from a Jeffersonian point of view, that the courts are intruding very viciously onto those kinds of hard-fought compromises and specific details that not only Speaker Wright, but the other 434 interested individuals have worked so hard on? Do you notice any kind of legislative outcry against judicial intrusion? Is it strictly something that we should only expect the president to defend?
No, there are any number of instances in which the mood in the House after a particular decision is, now how could they do that? We made it clear. We said what we wanted, and they've done the exact opposite. Now, those sentiments are not always well-founded, but they are there. I don't know if...
It's just good to hear.
And I'm not sure I would ascribe any Jeffersonian motive to it.
Ma'am?
Lee Lieberman. Question for, I guess, Professor Newborn and Mr. Ross. Let's imagine that there had been a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court saying that the Alien and Sedition Acts were constitutional and did not violate the First Amendment. And Jefferson becomes president. He didn't sign the bill. He decides that he is going to bring no cases under the Alien and Sedition Act because he thinks that they're unconstitutional. Is he doing something bad? Or isn't there perhaps something to be said for pluralism in constitutional interpretation as in other matters?
I guess you're really saying if my political ox gets gored, am I willing to say the same thing? I have the luxury of sitting in a room this afternoon and not having my political ox being gored, so I can say, yes, I am the world's most principled individual, and I never compromise principle. Whether in the real world when I sneak out of here I'll compromise it, I don't know. But I think the principled answer to your question is that if the Supreme Court had passed on the constitutionality of the Alien and Sedition Acts and had made it very clear that those acts were constitutional as they understood it to be, and the president believed that there were appropriate acts to bring within the discretion that any prosecutor has of allocating scarce resources among lots of cases, because no prosecutor can enforce all laws all the time. But within the general range of prosecutorial discretion, it would be inappropriate for him to say that is a law that I simply will not enforce because I don't agree with it.
And I would agree with that. The law is the law, whether we like it or not. There are ways of changing the law. But just as a law that an individual doesn't like does not provide the individual with an excuse to ignore it, neither is the executive branch excused from enforcing it.
I don't understand either of those two answers, I must say. Could we go back to the... No, Mr. May I call you Bert? We're not really going to, you indicated this, we're not really going to ask the prosecutor, the president, the attorney general to attempt to enforce all laws. That would be impossible. Presumably, each attorney general, each U.S. attorney, prosecutor, develops a set of priorities based on his values and those of his constituency. And we'll enforce from a menu of those values, and we'll just completely not enforce other laws, not enforce obscenity laws in this jurisdiction. Why should I do that, says the state's attorney? I keep not convincing juries.
It's one thing to make a judgment as a prosecutor that the allocation of your scarce resources is best used in enforcing another law because it would be socially defeating, you couldn't carry out the will, it would be an improper allocation of resources, it would be inefficient. There's a host of reasons why a good prosecutor makes hard judgments about where to put the resources of her or his office.
But what I think
is an illegitimate form of judgment is to say, even though I know I could enforce that law, I know I could make it stick, I know that it is something that that is within my capacity to do, I simply choose not to do it because I disagree with what the Supreme Court says the law is in this area.
Would you urge that more obscenity prosecutions be?
No, brought? I think they're socially self-defeating. But if a prosecutor thought otherwise, I would not go up to him and say, look, let's talk outside. Maybe I can persuade you that the Supreme Court is all wet in these things. And even though you'd be able to go get these bookstores and close them down, let me see if I can give you a brief that will persuade you even that the Supreme Court decisions are wrong. And if I can persuade you, then we can make a private deal about whether those laws get enforced. That's not the way a prosecutor should act.
Well, I would simply add that I took the question to have factored out things such as prosecutorial discretion. And my argument is not against there being any prosecutorial discretion. It was simply on whether based solely on a question of constitutionality.
The prosecutor can't have reservations about, gee, well, He has to cover his motive. I mean, I take it, for example.
He can have reservations because there's often legitimate doubt about whether something is or is not constitutional. But if you have the very same statute that was upheld the day before by the Supreme Court, and his reservations are strictly his personal reservations and not the reservations of what the Supreme Court of the United States says the law is at a particular time, then those are not appropriate reservations to take into account. And could he hide them? Sure. In the real world, will he be able to do something? Sure. Is it right? No.
I mustn't monopolize here.
Oh, well, I'd like to thank Professor Newborn for sort of leading into my question. My name is Mike Moyers from University of Tennessee. In the period between the Schechter decision in 1936 and the NLRB decisions of 37, the Roosevelt administration seemed to take the attitude of legislating first and litigating later. In other words, pushing statutes it knew the Supreme Court would invalidate with the at least secret purpose, I think, of shifting the blame for the Roosevelt administration's lack of ability to come up with reforms consistent with the Constitution onto the Supreme Court. I wanted to ask the panel if they believe that the executive or the Congress has a duty to at least consider the constitutionality of a bill before passage, and if so, does the passage of a bill which obviously violates the Constitution or which the Congress and or the executive reasonably should realize will be invalidated by the Supreme Court violates a trust, a public trust, in that public officials take oaths to uphold and support the Constitution.
Is this addressed to anyone in
particular? To anybody. Just go for it.
Well, okay. John, why don't you tackle that?
I will start by saying that I think the Congress has, congressmen have, a legal obligation under the Constitution not to vote for things that they think are constitutional, they think are unconstitutional. Thanks. We might be better off if it were the other way around. We'd get fewer laws. But I think it's what they think. I don't think they can say, I would vote. Well, they, you know, if they had an obligation to vote, and they thought it was constitutional, and the Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional, I don't know where the obligation to vote for it would have come from. Then I don't think the Supreme Court lets them off the hook in casting their vote. And I personally have, and this isn't the official position of the executive branch necessarily, I personally have serious reservations about the question whether the president can get off the hook signing a bill that he thinks is unconstitutional just because he knows the Supreme Court is going to uphold it. I am certain that he can do what Angie Jackson did, which was veto something that the Supreme Court had already upheld.
Great.
My sense is that it is the duty of a legislative branch to take into account what they believe the Supreme Court says the law is, and based on that good faith judgment, determine whether or not they are passing a constitutional act. Since that is almost always a question of very serious doubt, I think the practical consequences of it are very, very slim. You'd have to almost be repassing the same act the day after the court upheld it before you got a really tight issue. Most of the time, there are arguable distinctions between the statutes. If there are arguable distinctions between the statutes that the legislators in good faith feel distinguish the statute, then I think that's the end of the question. It's up to them.
I think if you put the question in terms of a public trust, I think, yes, a legislature that passes a law that they think is unconstitutional under judicial standards is breaching a public trust because they're bringing on a certain amount of unpredictability and disorder, but that there are other considerations sometimes that are more important than that, and if they're convinced that the court's judgment or predicted judgment is wrong, then I think they also have an even greater public trust to pass the law under their own judgment of the Constitution. I just add one additional factor to support that conclusion. What much of this discussion is skirting around is what are the sources of law? And it seems to me one of the sources of law or constitutional law, even the source of traditional legal meaning of constitutional law, is in fact, as Judge Posner said this morning, is the culture, and more specifically the political culture. And I think the political culture shouldn't be disabled from participating in that system, because if it is, even traditional legal indicators of meaning like text are going to be impoverished.
I would say that as a theoretical matter, members of Congress have an obligation to vote against legislation they believe to be unconstitutional. However, as a practical matter, it is very rarely that clear-cut when the matter is on the floor of the House. One good example is the Graham-Rudman Deficit Reduction Act, in which there were many people expressing the opinion that certain provisions of that statute were unconstitutional. While we all know that portions of the statute were held unconstitutional, it was not the portions that people were warning about. And so I think it is, it may be expecting more than is going to be there for the Congress to have a crystal clear idea of what will be held constitutional when you're talking about the types of legislation that are normally being considered.
Sir?
My question is for Mr. Harrison, some of whose phraseology leads me to wonder whether he is in fact quite so naive as he would have us believe. In responding to the question, for example, about the Competition and Contracting Act, you put the question as being whether the President has the right not to enforce that particular law. And maybe you got at this a little bit in your last question. John, is there any, what is it in your reasoning that, if we adopted it, wouldn't lead us to believe that the President, in fact, has the duty not to enforce such unconstitutional laws, where, in fact, the law and the prudential reasons that you cite are, in fact, in direct conflict? Mm-hmm.
I recognize the difficulty. The argument is, if the President thinks something is unconstitutional, how can he sign it even if the court will uphold it? How can he administer the law according to the court's view rather than his own, where he sincerely believes in his own? And I don't have a final answer to that, but the direction I would be looking for the answer, and the one that I'm satisfied with for the moment until I change my mind again, is that the President is really no different from any citizen on this subject. That legal obligation is legal obligation, and that the duty to take care that the laws are faithfully executed has various consequences, but they are not consequences to create an obligation in the President different from any other subject of the legal system. And so if we know that a citizen can ignore his own conscientiously formed view of the law and follow the courts, then I think that the other branches can do the same. So I think they are placed in the situation of a citizen where they can either stand on their own view and litigate and probably lose, or tell their consciences that they're going to go along with the courts instead.
Which is what Burt denies, exactly.
I was going to say, with respect, that begs the question of my position. The whole question is whether or not a member of the governmental family is to be treated identically as a private person in that situation.
Oh, sure.
You never said, by the way, why that distinction was. It's obvious why it would be important. But you didn't defend it. You just said it was important to observe it.
If there's time, I'll try.
Well, maybe you're right about that. Prudentially, we have half a dozen people.
Sure. I'm Gary Amos. I have a question for Professor Newborn.
Yes, sir.
Do I understand you correctly that from your position, you would reject Abraham Lincoln's rationale in his first inaugural address?
On Dred Scott?
Yes.
Well, the Lincoln position on Dred Scott is a complex one. Much of what Lincoln rejected in Dred Scott was dictum, and that so that makes it quite easy. There seems to me I know of no theoretician who believes that dictum has any self-executing binding quality, and I don't think a principled argument can be made for that. And 95% of Dred Scott is dictum. To the extent that Lincoln was urging that the holding of Dred Scott be disavowed by the federal government and not be complied with, rather than having it be overturned by some more constitutional means, the answer is, I think, yes, I do disagree. And in fact, Dred Scott was dealt with by the 13th and the 14th Amendment and not by executive non-acquiescence.
The part about the gypsies.
Does it bother you? Does it bother you that were you alive 120 years ago, taking this position, that you would have had the same jurisprudence as Jefferson Davis and the rest of my Southern colleagues? I mean, here it's kind of ironic because here I am, a Southern lawyer, appealing to New York Yankee not to think like the Confederates. I mean, after all, we did invade Pennsylvania.
And here, all the time, I didn't think you knew I was from New York. I thought I was covering it up.
And Bert, just to add to that, and I want to urge you not to support the impeachment of a governor who commutes the sentence of a man under a sentence of death because he thinks it's a cruel and unusual punishment.
No, we can discuss what the,
because
what the substantive...
Because he thinks it's a cruel and unusual punishment, and what, the courts have ruled.
What the substantive power of commutation is may carry with it the capacity of a governor to do all sorts of things that are extra-legal. That's the whole purpose of a commutation power, to do things outside of the general norm, general run of legality. So although it's an interesting question, I don't think it really is one that... But let me get back to Jefferson Davis. If what you're suggesting is that simply because a position is the same position that was argued by the Confederacy, it is somehow incapable of being a principled and correct position. Of course, that's not so. There were many arguments made in the Civil War by the losing side that were principled arguments, and they lost, and therefore the winning side defined them as wrong. That often happens in wars, but it doesn't necessarily mean that their position was an unprincipled position. What you had at the Civil War was a constitution that was at war with its basic moral principles. It was a constitution in which slavery was a significant element, and slavery was no longer a morally acceptable way of living within the society, and the society tore itself apart trying to deal with that constitutional principle.
That throws the onus back on the South, though. I think that's trivializing the issue.
Okay. I think we've.
If I were a black person, I'd be horrified by the position you're taking. That's just.
Are you? I don't know. The black people I represented in Cooper versus Aaron weren't terribly horrified.
Well, sir.
My question is for Mr.
Will you identify yourself for the record?
My name's John McGinnis. I'm from the Office of Legal Counsel, Department of Justice. My question is for Mr. Ross.
Can we start billing now?
I'd like to ask him how he can reconcile two of the propositions in his speech, one of which seemed to be that Congress had the right even against a Supreme Court decision on a particular bill simply to pass the bill again in the hopes that the Supreme Court would change its mind, with the position that I take that the executive was incorrect in a case like the Competition and Contracting Act, where there was no Supreme Court case clearly on point to refuse to carry that act out on the grounds that it was unconstitutional. Why is the President's oath to uphold the Constitution, which he takes seriously, not to give him this power? A power that you assert that the Congress has, even in the face of a particular Supreme Court decision. So I'm trying to avoid the question of whether there's a Supreme Court decision particularly on point, and put the question to you just starkly in terms of Congress's greater power to interpret the Constitution in its action legislating than the executive in its action executing the law.
Yeah, and I'll answer that two ways. One is the power that I claim for the Congress in the legislative process is the same power that I claim for the President in the legislative process. And one should not confuse that process with the implementation of the law once it's passed. During the legislative process, when an idea is being enacted, it is entirely appropriate for the President or the Congress to state what they believe they want the law to be. However, when you get outside the legislative process and you have an enacted statute, the President and the executive branch then have other obligations that they must carry out, which is to implement that law as it has been enacted. Let me suggest to you that the idea that the President's authority and duty to the Constitution
would excuse non-enforcement of a statute that he believes to be unconstitutional is a very dangerous toy to give to any executive. We all here at the table have agreed that the president may keep his view of the Constitution and its impact on a particular statutory scheme, notwithstanding a Supreme Court decision on the subject, and that the president can seek to have that decision overturned. If we were to allow the president's belief that the statute is not constitutional to serve as an excuse for non-enforcement of the statute, you would have a situation where no matter what happened, no matter how many times a statute was passed, no matter how many times it was upheld by the Supreme Court, a recalcitrant executive would simply ignore the law. That's not the system of government that we have.
May I? It would be an extremely dangerous power in the hands of the president not to enforce a law that Congress had passed because he thought it was unconstitutional. That is the same power as judicial review, which is also extremely dangerous.
And at the risk of surprising whoever asked the question, until the Supreme Court speaks, I think the president has equal provenance with the Congress on the issue of constitutionality. And if he has a conscientious scruple about enforcing that statute, I think that's what you have courts for. It's only after the courts have spoken that I would be troubled by a president who continued to refuse to enforce the statute.
Sure. My name is Richard Vigilante. And first I'd like to announce for anyone that's interested that I have several gypsy stories, but I can't tell them with the camera going. Professor Newborn, I think, correctly pointed out that what we're primarily discussing here is a question of philosophy of law with implications not so much for disposition of individual controversies, but for the effects of an idea on society and on government. And Professor Nagel pointed out some of those effects, suggesting the possible increased arrogance among the judiciary and increased timidity among the other branches or the citizenry. Professor Newborn made this concession on the grounds that the practical differences between a realpolitik approach to this question and a duty to obey resolution of it, the practical consequences were very little different, and then proceeded, he said, to address the philosophical issue. But both of his justifications for going for duty to obey were, in fact, profoundly practical. And if it's true that if his assertion about duty to obey and realpolitik producing very similar results, the points he made, you know, really oughtn't to be valid in practice. There oughtn't to be much difference in pre-event behavior because the incentives set up are so similar, as he asserted. And there oughtn't to be that much difference in the quality of protection that people with and without resources get in these two situations. Given that, isn't he in fact making an enormous philosophical grant of power to the court, essentially for no reason?
May I respond?
Yes, please. Now,
first, where I come from in New York, we don't really think that there's all that much difference between philosophy and practicality. I mean, pragmatism has a very important role to play in philosophy. Philosophy is not divorced from the real world, and I don't consider it a sin to make an argument based on legal theory which takes into account the implications in the real world of that legal theory. It is one of the things that good philosophers, I think, should do. But secondly, I think you misstate the position. In the vast bulk of situations, the issues would come out the same. The problem is, what do we do about those potentially very important situations where they do not come out the same? And now I have I should have made this disclosure at the beginning, because I think it's appropriate at a forum like this for you to know what my biases are. But I am counsel in a case in which I challenge the executive's failure to acquiesce in established precedent in the context of Social Security Administration cases. A real-world situation is, suppose the Supreme Court construes the Social Security Act as giving entitlement X, and the president believes that it gives entitlement Y. The Supreme Court's decision is unequivocal and correct. Is it then appropriate for the President of the United States, or lawful, not appropriate, is it lawful for the President of the United States to continue to administer the Social Security Administration so that individuals applying for the entitlement don't get it and have to take the government to court in case after case after case after case? And those people that don't have the sophistication to get to court don't get the entitlement. Now, that is not an ivory tower problem. That's the problem of hundreds of thousands of people over the last couple of years in the context of administrative non-acquiescence. And that's a very important practical question. And I think there's only one answer to it. The rule of law means that everybody gets the same benefits, whether or not they can afford a lawyer.
My question is for Professor Newborn. John Curry, I'm an Illinois trial lawyer, much like Mr. Lincoln, and I'm sorry that you trivialized his
your
precedent
hat?
Here. Pardon me? But my question is, and I think all the remarks since your presentation make pretty clear that there are all sorts of constitutional norms and levers which avoid, I think, some of the worst consequences both you and Mr. Ross point to. What I'd like to know at this point are what are the precise constitutional nightmares that we face if we do not accept your position that decisions of the Supreme Court should be treated as positive law?
Did I just say that? The constitutional nightmare, and I guess maybe you didn't hear it, the constitutional nightmare are dual. In large numbers of situations, not everything, but substantial numbers of settings, in National Labor Relations Board settings, in settings involving the Social Security Act, in settings involving the entitlement, the administration of the entitlement programs, to the extent the executive believes that its obligation to comply with Supreme Court precedent is essentially a prudential one, the executive picks and chooses based on, I'm sure, perfectly good faith judgments about whether it should or it should not comply. That means that it is then purely a function of the resources available to the particular group affected by the statute, which set of laws they live under. The wealthy will live under a set of laws that are enforced in the courts because they can afford to take the executive the next step. The poor, unless we provide them with vastly increased resources, and it is, I suggest, many of you, I think, would agree, absurdly inefficient to create a machine to enforce something which should have been done in the first place. But unless we're willing to create that machine, then the consequence of not giving the poor those resources is to say that there's two systems of law in the country, one for the rich and one for the poor, and that is a constitutional nightmare.
And well, if I may follow, sure, within precept of the advocacy system, but where is Mr. Ross's branch of the government and all that? Don't the so-called underprivileged or underclass have recourse to the legislative system to make up for that imbalance which you would say would occur in the advocacy system?
Well, would that it were so.
And if I could just follow up on that, I think not to denigrate the nightmare that Byrd identifies for individual citizens, I think if you're talking of constitutional nightmares, the system you suggest would also emasculate the legislative branch from being able to enact policy. The entitlements that Bert Newborn was talking about are entitlements which were guaranteed by the passage of a statute. And what you would be doing is you'd be giving the president a non-reviewable ability to negative a law, which goes far beyond the veto authority that is given.
Exactly. It's a de facto expansion of the veto power to enormous proportions.
To claim that much for it is to bracket back out, I think, the requirement that the view taken of the law by the executive has to be one sincerely held. And once you remember again that in the correct case we're talking about a situation where the executive really disagrees with the courts about what the law really means and may disagree with some members of Congress about what the law really means, then you are simply having to live with the consequences of separation of powers, where one group of people pass the law and somebody else executes them. For him to execute them incorrectly is a violation of constitutional responsibility. But for him to execute them to his best lights of his understanding and with an eye on various powerful considerations of prudence, and I think the arguments that Byrd has been making
as prudential arguments are strong ones, for him to execute the law that way is precisely what the arrangement we have in the Constitution contemplates.
In fairness to the current administration, I should make clear that I know of no situation in which they have refused in good faith to comply quickly and expeditiously with a decision of the Supreme Court in the area of entitlements. The litigation that we have going on now is what is the self-executing power of circuit court precedent within the intra-circuit geographical area. That's a much harder question, and we didn't get a chance to discuss that this afternoon. But I would not wish to give the impression that although the administration's theoretical position authorizes it to do so, I know of no situation in which it has in fact done so.
Yeah, and there are additional complications with the multi-circuit situation where the United States is attempting to preserve a question for eventual Supreme Court resolution, and we haven't gotten into that, and it can't. There are additional practical consequences, and if we had more time, the view of what is prudent or imprudent might shift as those consequences were appreciated more fully.
Sure.
My name is Robert Steigman. I'm an Illinois State trial judge. Mr. Ross drew the distinction that I thought was interesting between the president's power to interpret the Constitution in a legislative and non-legislative matter. I would be interested in whether Professor Newborn agrees in this context. Let's assume that the United States Supreme Court has been confronted with a draconian quota system, challenged reverse discrimination under the 14th Amendment, even more so than any they've dealt with so far, and the Supreme Court says, no problem, this is just fine. It's not offensive to the 14th Amendment. And shortly thereafter, the Congress passes some bill which proceeds to legislate along the same lines. Mm-hmm. No more, right, the same lines as approved by...
Codifies
the Supreme Court decision. It's presented to President Reagan, who vetoes it on the grounds that it is his judgment that this is an unconstitutional bill. Do you think that's an appropriate exercise because this is the legislative process? And when Ted Koppel calls you for Nightline, are you going to say, I'm not home?
Well, I've got to get, well, if I can get on Nightline, I'll have to tailor my position to see how I can get the most press. The answer, I think, is this. It's clear that the president is not obliged to, at least in my mind, it's clear in my mind the president is not obliged to sign the bill under those circumstances. The president doesn't have to subordinate his judgment about what is good policy to the judgment of the Supreme Court or to the courts or to the Congress. It would be, I believe, intellectually dishonest for him to couch his veto message in the grounds that it is unconstitutional. I think it would be much more intellectually honest for the president to say, the Supreme Court and I have a principal disagreement about what is constitutional here and what is not. I profoundly believe that they are wrong, the Supreme Court. I recognize that they have spoken, and therefore I cannot say to you that this bill is unconstitutional. I can say, however, that it is my judgment that it is unconstitutional or should be unconstitutional, and therefore, as president, I will not sign it. And I think that's appropriate.
Sir?
Doug Ginsburg. I'm a member of the Illinois State Bar, also. I just noticed that the discussion elided very smoothly from one of prosecutorial discretion to the situation described by the non-acquiescence policy. And I offer a distinction for your consideration that I think the hypertrophied sensitivities of a law professor can overcome, but the practical judgment might embrace. And that is that the president's decision, because of his own constitutional views, not to enforce a particular law, that's to say, because he believes that it's unconstitutional, stands on a very different footing than his placing impediments or burdens on citizens exercising a right or claiming an entitlement under an act of Congress, even if that burden is placed there on what are thought to be constitutional for constitutional reasons. The difference is that in the non-prosecution case, the president is deciding not to bring the coercive power of the state to bear on the individual. And that, I think, puts the decision on a very different footing than one where he decides to burden the individual, notwithstanding a congressional determination upheld by the Supreme Court, to the contrary. I think that we should err on the side of tolerating that decision, because as a practical matter, the alternative is not that the force will be exerted, but rather that the president, assuming now, remember that this is an act of conscience, is simply that the president will have to dissemble as to the grounds for the non-enforcement. That strikes me as an unhealthy result.
I wish I could buy into that distinction, because it would make my position a lot easier. While I don't disagree that I think the force of the distinction you make between the difference in imposing government power versus putting an obstacle, that distinction has force. But the force that it has for me is not to allow the president to justify what he's doing based on constitutional grounds when the Supreme Court has completely undercut that position. It seems to me that it ought to allow a law enforcement official to say, look, I'm not enforcing this within my prosecutorial discretion not to enforce. It's not because it's unconstitutional. I can't pass the buck and say that it's unconstitutional. It's that I take full responsibility for the judgment not to enforce this law. And if you want to do something to me, you can. You can vote me out of office, but I'm not going to hide behind the Constitution in making my judgment. That's right. That would be much more intellectually honest, and I think theoretically more correct.
But I think if you say the president could not hide behind the Constitution, but in fact he can't. In fact, he exposes himself to the further legislative response by invoking the Constitution. We saw that in the impoundment situation. And if the president were to say, for reasons of constitutional interpretation, that a particular law would not be enforced during his administration, what you would have is, instead of a law saying X is unlawful, you would have a new law passed by the Congress saying the Attorney General and the United States Attorneys must expend the following sums in the furtherance of this law and report back on all complaints received about under the statute every 6 months, and so on and so on. And so the tussle between the two branches would have been played out. That strikes me as a very unhealthy way of resolving the matter.
Maybe.
We can take one more comment from the floor. Judge? Oh, excuse me. I know we've been alternating, but I believe the judge was the first in time, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I'm Frank Easterberg, and I'm a member of the District of Columbia Bar. I've been troubled throughout this discussion by the fact that no one has articulated what he sees as the basis of judicial review. We've been trying to make comparative judgments about the extent to which particular branches are bound by constitutional constructions, without having articulated what that basis might be. It came out most forcefully in the exchange between Mr. Harrison and Professor Newborn, in which Mr. Newborn ended up saying, well, if it's true, as Mr. Harrison says, that there are right answers to constitutional questions, then obviously it follows that the executive, legislative, and judicial branches can give different answers. So from the fact that there are right answers, there are multiple answers.
That's what Martin Luther said, as I recall.
If, on the other hand, as Professor Newborn says, there are many possible answers, that is, the Constitution is indeterminate, there are very good arguments to be made on different sides. From the fact that there are many possible answers, it must follow that there is only one answer, that is, whatever answer the judge gives. It seems to me buried in that is a very unusual theory of judicial review, under which what the judge is doing is sorting from a large variety of permissible answers, announcing one, and that one becomes binding. But it seems to me that as soon as one says that there are a large variety of permissible answers, it ought to follow that no choice from within the permissible zone is necessarily binding on everyone else. In other words, that Mr. Harrison and Professor Newborn have things exactly backwards. If there is one right answer, everybody had better follow it. But if there are multiple permissible answers, we do not have a theory under which everyone must follow one answer.
The I think, answering for Professor Newborn, since we've got everything backwards, what his and then he can explain what I mean. His position is a theory of law under which you say
that since law is, that it's the gap again. Since law is constraint, but it still, it narrows you down, say, from 1,000 to 10 possibilities, you still have the 10 possibilities. And he adopts a rather, to me, interesting form of right answerism. The assumption is you have to have a right answer. And so his theory of law is that to get the right answer, you need the law and then a rule about the answerer, not about the answer. If you say there is a right answer, Martin Luther, from this point of view, was right. From a single answer, you can get multiple authoritative answerers, because the answer, the correctness, where the correctness of the answer is not defined by the character of the answerer, you will get from one truth multiple views. I don't. That is, I think, a wholly a surface paradox.
Taking it one step further, we promised that we wouldn't talk about European literary philosophers, but we didn't say anything about talking about comparative religion. In a very interesting way, the debate between the two of us and the paradox that Judge Easterbrook has pointed out is the paradox between Protestant theology and Catholic theology in terms of the interpretation of the Holy Writ. I've felt for some years now that the great discussion about using literary text as a paradigm for talking about the Constitution was somewhat beside the point. It is, as an ACLU lawyer, it's always seemed to me that there have been three groups that know that really know what constitutional adjudication is all about: Talmudic scholars, Jesuit seminarians, and ACLU lawyers. We have a holy text. We labor over it for a great deal of time, and we spend a good deal of time worrying about how the authoritative answer comes out. And you require a theory of an answerer. And what I was really saying is that, given my perception that law is essentially indeterminate in many, many settings, and that a false determinacy is essentially intellectually dishonest in many situations, and that if law is in fact indeterminate in many settings, and if, as I believe, the society requires that there be an authoritative voice so that we can have pre-event ordering and post-event equity, then you need a theory of an answerer that will allow one of the potential answers to become the authoritative one. And I believe Marbury gives us that. I mean, your perception that this whole debate begins with the legitimacy of judicial review is exactly right. It is in the necessity of deciding a case or controversy that I believe the judicial branch assumes the legitimacy of the answerer. It is the mechanism by which we have the authoritative voice that breaks us out of the trap of cacophony. Because I believe cacophony in the law is a terrible price that we would pay if we went any other way. I do not contend the Constitution compels it. I say the Constitution permits it, and it is so clearly better that that's the path we want to go down.
The Constitution, that itself is indeterminate and permits The substantive argument also operates at the meta level. The final metaphor I want to suggest about classical law, and I'm going to call my view classical, is that it's also classical as classical theories are distinguished from quantum theories. In quantum theories, there isn't a right answer about a lot of questions. Certain complementary characteristics of systems are simply not defined. In a classical theory, there are answers to all the questions, even if you're not sure what they are.
We could continue. Alas, we must not. Will you thank our panelists and...